Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to episode 36 of the Runner's World podcast, the weekly podcast bringing you all the latest running news, views and interviews. I'm Rick Pearson, the Runner's World section editor, and I'm here with Ben Hobson, the digital editor. Ben, tell us what we've got coming up this week.
Oh, it's a very special occasion this week. We are welcoming to the studio our first ever double Olympic gold winning superstar running champion, the amazing Dame Kelly Holmes.
Yeah.
As well as being one of the greatest runners Britain has ever produced, Kelly has been a brave and important voice when it comes to speaking out about mental health. As it's World Mental Health Day on October the 10th, it seems like a perfect time to speak with her on the subject and how running can help people to manage their own mental health.
Yes, what an absolute honour to have Kelly on the podcast. So without further ado, let's welcome our very, very special guest of the week.
Guest of the week. Here in the studio. Guest of the week. Sometimes on the phone.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Kelly, anyone following you on Twitter will see that running is still a huge part of your life, you know, and you get a lot of joy from it. What does running mean to you now?
I think running for me now is literally about me going out and doing something for myself,
yeah.
You know, whether that's physically and definitely mentally, you know, having that freedom. I mean, I'm fortunate that I can still run.
Yeah,
even
yeah.
Though I've been retired a long time. I kind of find running easy, which is a nice thing.
Yeah.
But it is about either socialising if I do park run or I just need some headspace. I go out, sometimes just about the fresh air and listen to the birds. I'm fortunate I live in the countryside.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just want a hard session and I kind of push myself a bit.
Did you find it hard initially, the transition then from being an athlete, it's your job, that's where a lot of the stress comes from and you associate it with having to run,
yeah.
And now you're allowed to run just because it's nice?
Yeah, I think initially I didn't run a lot after I retired because I felt like everybody would expect me to be racing every time if I turned up.
Yeah,
so I didn't
right.
want to do like just a 5K or 10K because all I'd have is like, oh, I don't know. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And believe it or not, I used to train blimmin' hard to get to where I got.
Yeah.
And then when you take that time off, it doesn't matter who you are. You're still like, you know, it takes a while. So for the first few years, I just couldn't almost. I ran for myself, but I never entered anything. And then I kind of had that thing of, you know, if I start a race, then I've started, I let people go, then I run amongst people and it became like I get a good workout because I'm running, but I'm also socialising. So it almost took the pressure off of me.
Yeah.
So I started doing it like that. Yeah, transition wise, it wasn't so bad because I'd been injured a lot, as everyone knows.
Mm.
I used to have to do a lot of gym anyway. So whether that be cardio or strength training.
Yeah.
And that was always part of my life. So instead of doing the running, I'd probably did more gym. Because I was used to it. So the transition wasn't so bad. It wasn't like that's all I did run and then missed running.
Yeah.
It was just my natural thing was to go into the gym and dot that. So I did more of that rather than run, I think.
Okay, cool. Mm. I mean, you mentioned injuries there. And that, I know your career, you know, you were dogged by lots of injuries. What effect did they have on your mental health, do you think?
Well, a huge effect. I mean, I've been very open and transparent about my journey. Initially, injuries were almost the driver to be successful because, for an example, you know, I got fourth at my first Olympic Games, I was 26, but I was running with a stress fracture. You know, I was having injections into the bone site to try and numb the pain, but it was the emotional and the physical element that's was the worst thing.
Mm.
But coming fourth, getting pipped on the line in the final made me think, like, oh, well, if I can come fourth at an Olympic Games running with a stretch fracture, I can do this.
For sure, yeah.
And that was the attitude I always had. So the same, I came out firing up the next year. It was World Championships. I broke the British record that stood for 12 years by Zola Budd, the barefoot runner from South Africa. And I was 5 seconds faster than anyone else in the world that year going into the World Champs. But I got a niggle in my Achilles tendon. I went and had some treatment in Germany, came back to the heats of the women's 1500 metres and completely ruptured my calf, completely tore the Achilles tendon. I'm hobbling down the track and told my career was over. But then I had the mental attitude to go, well, if I can be 5 seconds faster than anyone else in the world, number one, I can do this. So I kind of had all the highs and the lows, but I used the lows as a driver for the highs.
Yeah.
Then it just takes its toll, because you... you know, if you get an injury, the automatic thing is you go to see the physio or massage. They will deal with the injury. So there's one thing that your brain almost makes you think is that you're getting help, because they're helping the problem. And if they say, right, it's going to take 3 weeks, all you do is hold on to their 3 weeks' time. You do everything else outside of running to keep yourself fit and, you know, strong. But that's the kind of bit. But then it got to a point where, I suppose, in 2003, when, and again, I've been very open about this, I was getting ready for World Champs in Paris. I was in a holder camp 2 weeks before, and I just had a massive breakdown. I mean, like, literally. I looked myself in a mirror in the training camp, hated everything about me, everything about my body, wanted the floor to open up. I wanted to jump in, and I didn't want to see tomorrow. I saw some scissors on the side. I started cutting myself every time I'd been injured. It was a lot of times when you're wearing a crop top and a short, it's not that many paces you can hide, but hide you do, because, like, who did I tell? I didn't even know about mental health. I didn't want to tell my training partner and my coach, because you bring a negative effect on the team or the people around you. I didn't want to call my mum and my family, because they say, oh, but maybe she'd come home. I didn't want to come home. I wanted to be, like, good, you know, and so you end up dealing with it. And back then, we didn't talk about mental health yet. Within the period that I was at the darkest, you know, I describe it as like half of you's dying and half of you's trying to live, because you want to achieve your ultimate goal and dream. And I went to those World Championships and I stood on the rostrum and I got a silver medal around my neck for the 800 metres. So no one knew what was going on.
Yeah.
But it almost gave me the power to think, God, I can, you know, I'm going through hell, yet I'm succeeding. So I kind of took that on, I suppose, to the next year and realised that the only way I can be successful is to not get injured, not get ill. I mean, I had 7 years out of my 12-year career injured with something, or glandular fever, tonsillitis, yet I still won 10 medals before my two. So I knew I was always good enough, but it was just dealing with the highs and lows. Created the team around me that I said, you know, I need to keep injury free. I can't get injured anymore. And that's my only saviour to winning a gold. And fortunately, it all just came together.
And how? You mentioned before, Kelly, that, you know, back in 2003, people weren't speaking about mental health, and you were one of the first kind of voices to come out and actually speak bravely about it. Do you think we're in a better place now with mental health? Do you think we are more prepared to talk about, you know, if we're going through a low period?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wrote about it in my autobiography in 2005. And to be honest with you, I stand there on stage now when I do my talking and I show Athens a montage and I say, like, how many people remember this? And of course, hand goes up and it's like, I remember the face and the, you know, the eyes popping out. And then I say, how many of you remember that there was, like, front page of all these newspapers and expose that, you know, I'd been a self-harmer and all this through my career? And, like, they're like, no. I said, exactly, because it's fish and chip paper. No one was talking about it. It was almost like so taboo that you kind of think, geez, I can't pick that up again. It's almost to sell the book why it was on the front page, as opposed to there were interest. Then I went on a radio show, I mean a TV show, Loose Women, and we were talking about sort of health, well-being, and the princes coming out and talking. So I reiterated my story and they were all like a bit, oh, and I said, no, the only difference is that everyone's listening. My story's no different, and other people's aren't. It's just that we're now starting to talk about it. And so I've always been very honest and transparent and very open about what happened to me, because I think the only way I can stop stigmatism is to be more like, this is just real life, you know, humanise things a bit more, normalise conversation. It doesn't define you, doesn't stop you being successful in life, but guaranteed everyone's either suffered at some point in their life with something that's been really, for them, debilitating, or somebody they know. So why don't we just talk about it and then we'll help each other?
Yeah, agree. Completely
agree. Absolutely. It's a conversation that I think will save lives, which is super important.
Definitely.
Yeah. I suppose I look this side of it and just believe in fate, you know, because I, sounds a bit cliche, but for a living, I stand on stage and I try to motivate and inspire people, but I tell them about the journey to get there that was hard and ups and downs. And I almost believe that, you know, I went through all that to achieve something greater than I ever thought I could, so that now I can talk very openly about being successful, how you get there, what you're going to go through, and all of those things. So I know it's a weird way of thinking about it, but in a way, I just believe, you know, because when I was going through the hell, I used to say, what have I done? Like, I was always, you know, I had good values, I'd always done charity work, I'd always given, you know, and I just felt, why me? Like, literally, why me? I haven't given up. I try hard, I work hard, and I just kept thinking someone's trying to put me down. Yeah, they didn't put me down enough because I rose back up and you just keep going and then achieve what I did. Sometimes you have to compute that and just think, Jesus, what have I done? And then life just changes and it moulds into what you want it to be. And I just use the career as a way now of, one, helping people, and secondly, continue with the motivation to say that people can succeed.
When we talk about helping people, what message would you give to anyone who might be listening to this who is maybe suffering from anxiety, depression, or perhaps self-harming?
Yeah, well, I mean, just to be clear, like, self-harming isn't just cutting. It's also if, I don't know, if you had a one glass of wine in the evening just to chill out, and then that turned to half a bottle, then a bottle, because actually you're masking something that you're not quite happy about.
Yeah.
That's self-harming. Anything that's kind of giving an unrealistic perspective of life, you know, it's not something we should all do, just keep drinking all day or whatever, smoking 100 fag because you think you're stressed.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's important for people to identify. I kind of very basically sort of say ABC, like acceptance. Maybe accepting you need help, because a lot of people know they might do, especially now we're talking about it. It's making more people aware that maybe they might be struggling, because you're hearing so much more about it. So acceptance, I'd probably say, I don't necessarily like the word, but bravery in a way, to have the guts to kind of know that you need support and to go out and find that thing with somebody, or ask somebody for help, whoever that be, a friend, a colleague, a family member, or a medical profession, but go somewhere. And then, like, communication and connection, you know, when you communicate more effectively with people and you share, you find out somebody else wanted to do it as well.
Yeah.
I kind of always say there's like two people in this bit. It's kind of like the ones that stand on eggshells and know someone around them struggling, but don't really know or want to approach it because they're worried about what that is. And then there's the person that wants the help, is feels like a burden and thinks, if I'm going to say it, it's like I'm putting pressure on them, or what are they going to say to me, or are they going to go no? Like, if we meet sort of in the middle and start realising that actually we both communicate, then we might find out more about how we can help each other,
let's say. Yeah.
So that's kind of how I approach it now.
Like your,
help, talk.
Yeah, well, your podcast. So you have a lot of high profile people come on that, and who've equal, you know, experience as you, and sort of different experiences as well. So it allows people to have those conversations, right? Have you learned anything more from talking to these people? You know, you've been in the same room as people that you thought would definitely not have ever had an issue, and then all
it's fascinating. I have to say, I mean, my first one ever, first podcast, I'm going to Alistair Campbell's house and he's saying, oh, we're going upstairs, and I go, okay, so we're going upstairs, we're going to his bathroom, and I figure, okay, what are we doing? And he's got these bagpipes on the side and he says, oh, I'm going to play bagpipes. So I'm looking around thinking, where am I going to sit? So I had to put the toilet seat down, you know, I sit on his toilet and he's doing the bagpipes and I'm interviewing him thinking, this is a bit surreal, somebody's going to jump out on me and go like, yeah, you'd be framed, you know. It's like, oh. And he was fascinating. I really enjoyed speaking to him, as I did all the 10 people that I did, because, and he has, and he is anyway, he's very open. He says it in a way that's kind of you know, because he was in politics and at a height of his careers with sort of Tony Blair, and, you know, people would have a perception of a strong character under their point, but he was struggling, like, with psychosis and things, you know, and, you know, depression. But the one thing that probably stuck out to me more that day was him saying, if I hadn't have gone to do that interview, wouldn't have got out of bed. He was in a bad place that day.
Wow.
And I just thought, wow, just that power of connecting was really powerful. And he just said, thank you for coming. And I was like, geez, you know, I didn't know you weren't feeling well, but he just said it just helped him through that day. So you realise that people are suffering in all different times and different moments. Rory Brenner, at age 30, being diagnosed with ADHD, thinking that is that now defines him as a stand-up comedian? Mm. Is it because he was ADHD or actually is he good? He's like, oh, you know, and I went to see him in a fringe kind of event and we spoke about all this whole thing about how he now feels and how he acts and when he forgets something, it's like a black and white movie playing and he stops and I could see it all because I'd spoken to him. I'm thinking, oh, I'd never have known.
No.
So it's only when you actually get to know, and I think that's why these sort of things are so powerful. Because if you can hear people's stories, you can realise, one, you're not alone, and secondly, people that are successful, let's say, because that's what a lot of people unfortunately measure themselves against, seeing in someone that they're inspired by in the public eye, you can look at that and go, oh, well, it wasn't all that easy, and you've not got it all on a plate.
Yeah,
I think that's empowering for people.
So to go back to the bagpipes quickly, because my understanding is that he plays bagpipes.
He's very good.
To calm down, and it makes him happy, right?
Yeah.
So what makes you happy? When are you happiest?
Going out running, just because I enjoy it now. Don't have to have any pressure. Yeah. With my family, I have 9 nieces and nephews. I can't think of any better time than just having them because I'm the biggest kid out of my family, even though I'm the oldest. I don't care. I don't do age at all. I don't want to age. And anyone that says they enjoy aging are lying. I go to theatre and I love musicals because it's my place to switch off. After I finish this podcast with you, I'm going with my 3 of my brothers and we're going to a play. And I just love it because I don't have to have my phone. I don't email. I don't speak to anyone. I just sit there absorbed in something. So I'm just happy when I'm maybe just doing things. And also what I love, you know, I am driven. I don't switch off. People say to me, switch off. I can't. I can't switch off. So I'd use those little bits of things that, okay, people think I should switch off, so I'll go and do something I enjoy. But I'm just happy being me. When I'm happy, I'm happy.
It would be an error on our behalf to not talk to you about winning 2 gold medals. Because, I mean, as you mentioned the iconic image of you crossing the line and your sort of face of realisation of what you'd achieved, but how does that feel?
I don't know. I mean, I do know, but I don't know how to describe it. It's... you know, when I won 800, like I say, it was such a shock almost. I couldn't comprehend that I'd won it. And then I'm being told, okay, that's not the medal you came for. You wanted to be Olympic 1500 metres champion for 20 years. Put it in the box and pretend you haven't got it. And I'm like, yeah, really? Seriously? You know, I wanted a party. And everyone's going, but you're in the shape of your life and do not ruin. This is a time when you can actually achieve what you've always wanted. You're not fighting against anything. You're not trying to grab. You know, I doubled up at most championships I went to despite my injuries, but I never fulfilled my full potential. And I suppose I just realised, you know, that I've let myself down in the past where I've kind of, my head has switched off because I've got one medal and I could have won another, but I'm like, I'm just happy with whatever one I've grabbed. So finishing the 1500, honestly, seriously, was just, it was like a big ton weight like went off my shoulders because people do not and would never know, obviously, the pressure I felt myself under to just do what I believed I was. And a lot of that was maybe just some external, I'm not religious, but some external sort of force going, right, this is your moment. But also just wanting it so badly for those years. But I had to at that time not think like that. All I had to do is now I was in the shape of my life. My times I'd been running had been amazing. I'd been like ranked number, I think, 2 of the 800 in the world that year anyway. I'd lost all my 1500 metres, I have to say, that year because I put so much pressure on myself. Almost like, you know, I can do this, but if I'd allowed myself to really think about it too much, I would never. So when I went into the 1500, it was almost like, well, if I come back with any colour, I mean, how great to be Olympic champion and get another medal.
Sure.
I mean, that hadn't really been hadn't happened in women sport at all. So I was like, well, that'd be great. So I took the pressure off me, thinking just in the shape of my life, I know what I need to do, just run. And I felt like, I actually felt, and I ended up having an angel written on my shoulder because I've literally felt like something was lifting me, like I was kind of just floating. Oh. I've only ever had that 3 times in my career, and I've had it when I broke the British record for the 1500 metres that stood for 12 years at the Olympic Games in Sydney when I should not have even been at those games. I had 6 weeks of running only. The rest was in the gym and the pool and just... keep him fit because I'd had a 12-centimetre calf tear and I was leading with 30 metres to go in the final of the women's 800. And the only reason I probably didn't win gold is I scared myself. I looked up at the big screen and thought, I'm in front. Yeah. Like literally. Yeah. And I suddenly tightened up and then, you know, one went past, another went past and suddenly I got a bronze medal. But I felt that euphoria type thing.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing feeling because it's like anyone, maybe, you know, don't look at it as Olympics, but you know, you could have got a PB or you could have done something you never thought you'd ever do. Yeah. Like even as a park run or your first couch to 5K and you've done it, or your first marathon, or just something where the starting point was, oh God, this is like hard. And then you do it, you know, multiply it, maybe by a million because it's kind of in a big stadium and it's a thing. Yeah. But it's just still that thought process of, wow, I've done it. And it was what I, you know, I couldn't believe it at the start. Have to say, 3 months later, I was still pinching myself, thinking I'm kind of in a coma or so. I go wake up and be on the start line. It's like it's just surreal. I can't explain it other than that.
You mentioned parkrun in there, and I know you're a big ambassador of parkrun. I just wondered what.
I'm just a fan. I'm not even an ambassador as such. I'm just a fan of it.
So what is it that you like about parkrun? And do you think it's an avenue for people to improve maybe their mental health as well as their physical health?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a fantastic movement. I've done a lot. I enjoy it. I did a TV documentary about it on BBC. It was what I believe it's done is it's a movement. You know, it's a movement where people can come together, firstly, for a social element, a commitment. You know, 9 o'clock on the morning in the UK, 9:30 other places, 8 o'clock other places. But it's a commitment to go to an event and do 5K. It does not matter whether you're walking, whether you are sprinting, whether you're using it as a sense of getting back over something. So, like, I know people that have got over, like, even last weekend, I was down in Chichester, you know, triple heart bypass.
Yeah.
There just because wants to do it and wants to prove so he can get better, right? Come last, 223 people, I think it was, came last. I got my dad doing it. He done run. I've started him off. He's just turned 70. I started him off in January.
Great.
In January 2019 this year. And I just said, you've got to be healthier. You can't live your life like this. I made him do this park run because the family went down to Chichester for his weekend. And I said, you're doing a park run. I said, walk. I said, the only thing is you're not coming last because that lady's had a triple heart bypass. You have no excuse. And he came 220th out of 223. I was so proud because he did it.
Yeah.
The park run enables people to come together. It's a social event first and foremost. It's a physical achievement because you're doing 5K, however you want to do it. And definitely a mental health because so many people go there because it stops isolation. It helps with that. I say communication, socialising, and a feeling of achievement in a way.
Definitely.
You know, you've got dogs, buggies, young kids, adults. You've got those people that are using it as a training session. So go off and sprint and do 16 minutes. Brilliant. Yeah. Go and do it. Or you can do 55 minutes like my dad. Brilliant.
Yeah.
You've done it. We're all only doing 5K.
Yeah.
I love it. I just turn up, rock up at one that I'm working at and take a few, you know. Do a little tour. Hi, I'm there. Run, take photos and then go.
Yeah. I've seen you running back as well, sort of high-five people as you finish.
I always do that. As soon as I finish, I go back through the field because I always want them to do like that kind of give back thing, you know, like we put a vest on or a T-shirt the first 10 or 20 people and then I go back through and cheer everyone on because, you know, I'm not there at parkrun to win a gold medal. I'm there just because I want to do a 5K and it actually makes me do something on a Saturday morning and I interact and do it. It's different. All the courses are different that I go to. I just love it. So if I can go back and motivate people and cheer them on, they think that by them walking or jogging slow isn't like embarrassing. It's like, I'm going, well done, brilliant. At least you're here. Yeah. It's a lot of people still in bed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not doing anything.
I've got a question. This is more of a light-hearted question, Kelly. This is about Athens. And we did a piece in one as well recently about the best running haircuts.
And your, deep journalism.
And your haircut in Athens made it in.
Oh.
And there's a funny story, isn't there? Because you went over and didn't wasn't it a chance meeting that led to this to these braids or not?
Yes. Okay, so this is the story. I'll try and be as quick as I can. I was in Aphrodite, Cyprus, where the British holding camp was.
Right.
And we'd been there a couple of weeks, I think. And my hair... I can't even remember how my hair was before it, but I was thinking, well, I need it braided because I have a big deal with my hair. And I thought, I do not want my hair to be overcome, the fact, what I'm, you know, like kind of override why I'm actually there and worry about what my hair looked like. Not that I really cared about what I looked like when I was an athlete at all, but my hair was an issue. So I wanted it braided. Now, you probably remember Darren Campbell. Who was part of the winning 4x4 gold medal team, 4x1, sorry, gold medal team in Athens. Anyway, he had a training partner there who convinced me that he could braid hair because he did his sister's.
Right.
So we go off, we've gone done our training, everyone's done it. I'm just thinking, well, I've had my hair taken out. I'm waiting for this guy to turn up. I won't say his name, embarrass him. anyway, he comes down. He said, oh, has anyone got a comb? I went, no, haven't you got a comb? And he said, no, so we got a pen lid. And he's like, oh, you separate my hair with a pen lid. I went, are you sure? So anyway, he's doing it. Anyway, Darren Campbell had had a little, small little niggle that people were worried about. So he goes, I've got to go off to him. I'm now sitting there with my hair like literally like a fro, thinking he better come back. There was no one else that could braid hair.
Right.
All the sprinters that did have their hair done were in a different location. They were all going off to Athens. I was thinking, you actually kidding me? Like that. Anyway. What happened to us is earlier on in the day, we'd been down at a beach, Aphrodite's, and we're playing skimming and all of that. And I'd become skimming Olympic champion because I was crap at every throw until I said, right, next one's for the Olympic title. I'm like, I was like, yeah, Olympic. Anyway, this family came over and said, oh, Kelly Owens, blah, blah, blah. I said, hi. And we're just chatting. Everyone's having photos. And there's actually a little film clip of this. It's so funny. Yeah. I've seen it. Anyway, they go off. This woman comes back. She went, hi, my name's Pat and I'm a hairdresser in London. So if you ever need me, give me a call. She gave me a card to put it in my pocket.
Right.
So this is just a chance meeting.
Yeah.
Anyway, obviously, roll back. It's night time. I've got an afro. The girl said, one of the girls that was with me said, what about that lady you met on the beach? I went, she lives on a random beach. And she's on holiday. Like, she's going to be able to do it. She went, call her. So I called this number. I went, beep. Oh no. And I was literally going to cry. She went, call it again. I called it. And I went, hi. And I went, hi, Pat. Because I was reading her thing. I said, my name's Kelly Holmes. You met me on the beach. She went, oh, yeah. I said, this is going to be sound really weird, and I know you're going to say no, but are you anywhere near Aphrodite's? And she went, yeah, we're only like sort of down the road.
Yeah.
And I went, well, I am desperate. Can you braid hair? Can you come up to a holding cab? She went, yeah. And she said, actually, this is funny. We just cancelled our trip because my son's a bit ill tomorrow, so I can come up tomorrow. And I was leaving that night. I was thinking, oh, my God, genius. Anyway, she comes up, does my hair, looks brilliant. I jump off. I'm like, yes, I'm ready. Anyway, she goes to me. She went, God, it's so weird. She went, we'd run out of petrol, right? This is her side of it now. Right. So I've got the side of this random person comes up with this card. She says, we're now driving. We've run out of petrol. She says to her husband, Phil, I need to stop at this beach. Phil was going, we're not stopping. We've run out of petrol. There's no garage. She went, I have to stop. So she comes onto the beach, massive beach. She just sees this group of people. And she said, I was drawn to this group of people. Then I saw you. Then I went off. And then I thought, oh, God, I've got to give her my card. So she came, like, give her my card.
Yeah, wow.
And then she says to me, and the thing is, I've never, ever, ever travelled before with all my hair equipment. I just for some reason, pull it in on our trip to Cyprus.
Wow.
And we're best friends now.
That's crazy.
An amazing story. That's such a good incredible story.
I called her 2 weeks later after the Olympics. I was finally undoing all my bags and I saw the card at the bottom of my bag. I was like, oh, that Pat. So I called her and I said, Pat, it's Kelly. And she was screaming because now I'm double Olympic champion, aren't I? You know what I mean? She went, like that. And I said, oh, no, it was the hair. So, yeah, that was the story. And the other very quickly part of that story is obviously I had to have it redone because I wanted it to be neat.
Yeah.
So now I need it kind of refreshed for the 1500 metres right. And I'm thinking, right, who am I going to get to do this? And somebody said, oh, go to the Jamaican team, they're bound to do it. I'm thinking, oh yeah. So I went in and I'm sitting in this apartment and this girl starts doing it, and Merlin Otte, who's like one of the world's famous sprinters for years when I grew up, sitting there next to me having my hair braided, and I'm just thinking, like, life is so surreal. Yeah. It's so weird.
I bet that Pat's hairdresser, she's got a picture of you, right? Mm-hmm. Winning that, gotta be.
Yeah, of course.
Gotta be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Imagine that. It's an amazing bit of advertising for your hairdressing skills.
Yeah, so, the Olympic champion.
Yeah, Olympic hair.
Slipstream.
Yeah, slipstream hair. That'd be amazing, yeah. Well, that's an amazing story. Wow. Yeah, I can see why, you know, when you start thinking all those, I mean, you could call it coincidence if you want, but it feels like there was a kind of...
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It does feel like there's some kind of cosmic energy towards actually all these things going right for you in Athens.
I swear there was, you know, because the same place. So last race, last track session, I was at this, last track session, I was going to do this 2 400 metres. And all it was 2 400 metres. I think I was aiming for like 53 seconds, so 10 minutes recovering. That was it. It was my last sort of bit fired up session. Anyway, I was getting ready to go, and Anthony, the training partner, was in the front, and Zara Hyde-Peters, who used to be part of the performance team for British Athletics, was driving. I'm sitting in the back, all separate radio, going down. I was really nervous because it was going to make me decide, do I do the 8, the 15 or both? It was all riding on this one session. So we're going down, separate radio. And I went, oh my God, I seriously could do listening to Tina Turner, Simply the Best right now. As I said it, Anthony turned the radio, it came on. That song, swear to God.
So like, goosebumps.
And we sat outside the stage, and I was like, no one spoke. It was no what way. Is this? And then I went and ran my fastest times I've ever run in my whole career for 400.
Yeah.
The 4x4 team had done roughly the same distance, and I even beat their times. I mean, it was ridiculous. Wow. I was flying.
Yeah.
There was all these little things. I could go on forever, all these bits that happened to me, but we ain't got time.
Kelly, tell us a little bit more about your book, Running Life, then.
Yeah, so I did a book at the beginning of the year. I was asked whether I'd like to do another one. I was thinking, shall I, shan't I? And there was a lot on the fitness industry, because I do a lot more in the fitness industry. And I thought, there's a lot on fitness, a lot on nutrition. What elements can I bring in? So actually, what this book has is probably 40% is to do with mindset and mental health awareness, because it's all about kind of, if you want to change something, either you want to get fitter, stronger, faster, lose weight, whatever, you can do all that through training and exercise and diet and nutrition. But if your brain doesn't say you're going to do it or commit to something, then you're on a back foot already.
Right.
But if actually you're in a bad place in your life, but you know fitness and exercise is going to help you, but you're not ready to accept that actually that is part of self-help, again, you're not going to do anything. So the book really covers a lot on motivation, mindset and mental health awareness and self-help tips. So it's more like, it's very colourful, lots of nice photos, lots of nice recipes. So whatever stage you are feeling, whether it's a positive one, you'll go to the fitness and there's running tips and there's training things that I used to do. You know, there's recipes from, I used to have a coffee house, so there's recipes in there. And then the other bit is like, so it's more like a coffee table book. If you want to open it up and you're having a bad day, it gives you tips and things of how you can just help yourself through that period of time that you're feeling quite low. And I'm really pleased with it, just because it really captures what people now are talking about, but in a more relaxed home setting. You know, just have it on your side, don't have to really tell anyone, but you can think about things yourself and help So, yeah, I'm really pleased with that, actually. Yeah.
We were looking at your Wikipedia page earlier.
Oh, God. I haven't looked at that for years. Probably wrong.
Well, no, well, this is it. So there were a few things that popped up, which we were just suddenly, we were certainly unaware.
We're like, true or not, yeah.
Yeah. So were you a lorry driver?
Yes, I was a heavy goods vehicle driver in the army. I joined when I was just before 17. Dream of mine since I was 14 to be in the army as a physical training instructor, not to be a lorry driver, but I joined because I was desperate to get in, yeah. Yes. And I've just renewed my licence only because, like, if it all fails, I can drive a truck. Yeah. Or actually, it's quite a nice starting point when you're doing, like, something for the, I don't know, some industries I talk to, and it's all kind of like transportation right. or something. I'm like, I got my licence.
I got the licence. Nice. Also, they said that you were the judo champion.
Yeah, in the army. Yeah, just for a year, I was army judo champion. I tried to give everything a go. Yeah. And then you get lots of injuries because you're getting thrown and slung everywhere.
Were you good at every sport then? You were kind of people who just, okay, right. But running was obviously you're good at running.
I was running since I was 12. But no, definitely not. I mean, I failed my first selection for become a PTI because I was only good at running. I couldn't catch a ball. I still can't. But I couldn't catch a ball. Couldn't do ball sports at all. Wasn't ever a swimmer. And when I failed, that sense of failure and someone telling me I wasn't good drove me to be better. So I put myself in every single course you can imagine in the army and then went for my next selection, became top student in it. And then I transferred to become a PTI when I was 21. And that was one of my dreams come true.
That seems to be a real pattern of your life, is that you don't let a setback put you off stuff. It's like a real driver for you to do that.
Yeah, because you still get disappointed, you know, still it hurts as much as anything else when you don't achieve. Mm. I think people should take that in life, you know. It's like if something makes you feel bad or you feel disappointed or upset, you obviously want it. Because otherwise you wouldn't care. You'd be like, oh, I can't bother.
Yeah.
Mm. Whereas everything I do and put my mind to, I care about because I want it to be good.
Yeah.
So I get disappointed. I still cry. I still feel like people don't believe in me. I still feel like, oh, I'm not good at things. But it just drives me to try and get better.
Well, Kelly, thanks so much for making the time to speak with us on our podcast.
Thank you.
It was absolutely amazing to have you on the show and a real honour and a privilege for me and Ben to speak to you. So thank you
so much. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
One of the nice things about working for Runner's World is we receive lots of letters from readers.
Yeah.
About loads of stuff. But I thought I'd read one out that's specifically about how running has helped somebody's mental health. And this guy is called Ben Fowler. And he emailed in and said, in short, running and runners have inspired me to live again. I've been suffering from severe anxiety and depression for over 3 months. At least this was when I was diagnosed. But as it turns out, it's more like 12 years. In these 3 months, I've tried loads of things: counselling, medication, yoga, wellness and mindfulness. The only thing that's really helped, though, has been running. He's read two books in particular that have changed his life. Jog On by Bella Mackey, who, of course, experienced anxiety and wrote about it so well. And Born to Run by Chris McDougall. Since then, I've been running every day, he says. Not only this, but I've signed up for my first race, the Gower Marathon, and have eyes on two ultras next year. I cannot stress enough how much running has helped me to overcome my emotions and personal difficulties. So he says, yes, without running, I'm not sure the person writing this email would be emailing you. So, I mean, and honestly, we get, that's a particularly powerful letter, but we get lots of those in. And it's people aren't alone in these things. And I think it's great that more and more people are being prepared to open up about mental health.
Yeah, and as Kelly was saying, just the importance of communication. So even if it is writing a letter to people that you perhaps don't know, but you know, you enjoy running and you want to share your story, then please do podcast@runnersworld.co.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
His fingers on the button, his ears to the ground. He's done a bit of Googling and he's had a nose around. He's a detective wearing running shoes. Kerry McCarthy and his weekly running news.
He's here. Both barrels of his running news shotgun are locked and loaded. Welcome back, Kerry.
What can I say to an introduction like that? For once, I have no pithy comeback. I'm just going to wallow in that introduction. Thank you very much. Good morning to you both. So I've got three bits to go through this week. You, listeners won't be surprised to hear that two of them are sort of world championship related. Mm. The first one, tangentially, and it's something that probably most runners, if they're track and field fans, will have heard about, is the banning of Alberto Salazar, the legendary coach. last week, 6 days ago, I think now. He was banned for 4 years for doping violations. A quick rundown. He was banned for kind of multiple transgressions, really. There's been a lot of rumblings about Salazar for a while, which is, you know, which is really unfortunate. I mean, when you go back to his own career as an athlete, he was known as, you know, one of those guys who would run until he dropped. And a couple of times he literally did. He was three-time winner of the New York Marathon from 1980 to 82, won the Boston Marathon. He went into coaching in, I think, 1996. And really, that's where his kind of desire to win took a bit of a wrong turn, it seems. He first coached famous athlete Mary Decker in 96. She was banned in 97. Testosterone, yeah. As far back as then. You fast forward a little bit, there were rumblings in 2011, which is when Mo Farah moved over to Oregon to be coached by him. In 2013, Kara Goucher, the American athlete, basically turned whistleblower and said she'd been pressured to take thyroid medication. There's been a lot going on since then, and this is basically the culmination of, a 6-year investigation. And I don't think anybody's surprised, in as far as Salazar used to carry testosterone around in his bags and say, don't anybody touch my bags. I don't want them to be contaminated. I've got testosterone in there. And his story was that he was conducting experiments to find out what the minimum level of testosterone would be that would show up in an athlete's system, because he was apparently paranoid that his athletes would get spiked, effectively, some kind of like muscle rub with testosterone and it introduced to them.
Yeah, right.
Little bit odd.
Yeah.
Yeah, and basically now they have lots of whistleblower testimony, lots of proof, it seems. He's been banned for 4 years. Seb Kerr, in his role as the IWF president, has basically instructed all athletes who have been coached by him to sever all ties. At the same time, I should say, as saying that none of these athletes should be tarnished just because they coached under him. Sifan Hassan, the Ethiopian Dutch athlete, who you may have seen on your telly box over the last few days, she was the lady in the orange vest who ran an unprecedented double of gold medals in the 1,500 metres and 10,000 metres, which is astonishing, Brett. She's coached by Salazar. She was very angry about the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, she posted about it sort of in the rhetoric was kind of almost in the how dare they interrupt my training before the Worlds. Was that her?
That was her. Yeah, she swore in the BBC and, you know, live and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And was really worked up about it. But
I mean, the big thing about this is, how can a coach... And this is the question that's been asked a lot on social media. How can a coach be banned for doping violations yet no athlete has been found? Like, so what's he doing?
You know, the rules basically state that even if the athlete is unaware of what's happening, if they're found to have doped, then if they have something in the system, they get banned.
Yeah.
So it's a really good question, because he was kind of experimenting on athletes, and some, you know, this endocrinologist Jeffrey Brown was brought in by the Nike Origin Project, which is basically a project set up by Nike years ago specifically to help US athletes compete with African long distance athletes. And Mo Farah was a bit of an aberration, not being an American, obviously. He was kind of, I think, the first non-American to go and join the group. But then Jeffrey Brown was brought in, and lo and behold, suddenly all these athletes who never knew they had asthma were being diagnosed with asthma and saying, take this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember Michael Johnson was speaking about when Hassan was very angry on the BBC, and he said that actually getting angry about this isn't enough. If you go and train with, and I think she went over to Salazar when he was under investigation in 2017, that's not the best response. What you need to do is say, look, I'm an advocate for clean sport. I'm happy to be investigated whenever you want. You can look at my old record. That's the kind of way that hopefully can rebuild trust, not just becoming irate about people's lack of trust.
You've just answered the question that I was going to pose, though, Rick, which is really, as Brits, the question that everybody is going to be thinking about now is, what does Mo Farah know, and what does he do now?
Yeah.
Because there is no suggestion that he's guilty of any transgressions. He no longer works with Salazar. He left him 2 years ago and now works with Gary Luff, Paula Radcliffe's husband. But Salazar did oversee his transformation
and his
perennial sixth place finisher to you know, world beater.
Yeah.
So obviously the British media are going to be digging around, you know, what should Farah's response to this be?
Yeah, and presumably there'll be sort of further investigation into Farah and other athletes as a result of this investigation, I should think.
Yeah, I would have thought so. But I think, you know, the point that you made that about Michael Johnson's thoughts on if you've got nothing to hide, then just go, okay, bring it on.
Yeah.
You know, test me every day if you want.
Yeah.
Anyway, so moving on from that, all very tawdry, something slightly more amusing, or at least it is to me, it's about the Norwegian athlete Philip Ingebrigtsen. If you think you have it rough during a mass start half marathon, all the elbows and tripping and couples holding hands that you've got to dodge around, think of poor old Tedese Lemmy of Ethiopia. It was all going off during the final lap of the 1500 metre heats in Doha. Everyone jostling position. You've seen it many times. Norwegian athlete Ingebrigtsen then gets a bit irate and punches Lemmy in the back. Mm. Not even subtle about it. And then cuts him up from behind, trips him up. Lemmy goes down like a sack of spuds, gets trampled by the rest of the pack. Ingebrigtsen nips over his prostrate body and finishes the race, qualifies for the semi-final, not disqualified.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's teaching us the lesson that violence pays, but...
He did. But
it's absolutely remarkable.
If you watch the video, he thumped him.
Like, the thump wasn't initially seen. And actually, I remember, I think, I don't know if it was Cram or someone commented, said, the trip itself, that could be enough to be banned.
Yeah.
And then this little rabbit punch goes in beforehand. It's unbelievable that he wasn't banned.
And finally, more proof for all you runners that you're awesome and that doing what you do is going to keep you alive for longer. Yay.
Yeah.
So this segment is basically just an invitation for me to pat yourself on the back if you're listening to this. Feel even better about yourself for the steps that you take quite literally every week to keep the old chap with the hooded cowl and the scythe at bay. And if you're in a bit of a fallow mojo period, this will hopefully be, the electrode to the private parts that you need. There's new research out of Norwegian University of Science and Technology, which suggests that a couple of decades of low activity lifestyle doesn't merely increase your risk of premature death, it doubles it.
Right.
There's perhaps no surprise there to kind of learn that if you sit on your backside, it's not going to go well. But there's also the sobering thought that if you are active and then stop being active, the benefits that you've built up are just going to disappear.
Yeah. Oh, no.
You have to keep it up, basically. So here's some context on how they did the study. Basically, collected data three times over a 22-year period. An activity was categorised as inactive, i.e. nothing, moderate, fewer than 2 hours a week, and high at more than 2 hours weekly. Those who reported being inactive in the first two data collection periods had double the risk of dying and a staggering almost three times greater risk of dying from cardiovascular disease.
Wow.
People who were super active early on but later became sedentary experienced a similar risk as those who were always inactive. Those who started sedentary but later upped their game, if you've come to running late, maybe didn't start till your 40s, 50s, 60s, people inactive at the start but who later exercised for more than 2 hours a week still had an increased chance of, slightly increased chance of early death, but it was much, much smaller than those who had always been inactive or those who had just kind of like given it up. So the takeaway message is basically becoming inactive is associated with about the same increase for mortality as sustained inactivity. So don't be thinking that, that egg and spoon race in 1998 is still going to see you right all the way into your retirement. You've got to keep it going.
Yeah.
So if you're listening to this as a former runner or perhaps are new to running, but you used to exercise and haven't for a long time, suspect you should be doing something about it, then well done, because you absolutely should be doing.
Kerry, that's great. Thanks very much for your weekly running news, and we'll see you next week.
Cheers.
That brings us to the end of this very special Runner's World podcast. I'd like to say a huge, huge thanks to our guest, Dame Kelly Holmes, and to Number 8 Studios in Soho, of course, where this was recorded.
For more news, reviews, interviews and much, much more from the wider world of running, please head over to runnersworld.com/UK. Please like and subscribe on iTunes. Leave a message saying how much you love Dame Kelly. And thanks to Acast, our hosting partner. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free
or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.